Joe, you're back. How you doing?
I am great, Tim, and it's great to be back. So tonight we're going to talk about civil rights and the pros and cons of the effects of the civil rights movement and the civil rights legislation that have changed the United States to such a large degree. Tim, just sort of help orient us, like, let's go back to, you know, 1955. What really went on over the next 10 years from that point that's kind of referred to as the civil rights movement and then with the civil rights, with the Voting Act? Can you just kind of talk about what precipitated it? What were some of the stuff that they did? And then what are kind of some of the questions that have come out of the results of this really what I see as a, basically a catastrophic process, at least in terms of the results for the United States?
Well, in the 1950s, particularly after 1955, after the Korean War ended, this is the middle of the Cold War, height of the Cold War, you had sort of this coalescence or forming of an organized civil rights movement among black Americans, particularly in the South, but also in the North. But it was mainly active in the South because of the era of Jim Crow. For the better part of a century, the South, Jim Crow had reigned after post-Reconstruction period. You're dealing with the impoverishment and destruction of the Southern economy. And, of course, in the 1930s, 40s, you had this mass migration north into the industrial centers of the country. Detroit, this is largely a filling a need for labor in the munition factories during World War II, but it has also created a demographic shift in the north and created a lot of problems, racial problems, particularly in the ethnic neighborhoods, the Italian, Polish, German, Irish ethnic neighborhoods of some of these industrial cities like Detroit, and so you had a lot of blacks moving north in the 1940s from the impoverished South, seeking jobs in the factories. We've talked about how this was part of a social engineering scheme, ethnic demographic warfare, of weaponized migration to achieve a political agenda, a social political agenda, to break up the ethnic neighborhoods and also create the create suburbia. This also coincided with the creation of the Interstate Highway System, which was a government program to create suburbia. And this fundamentally changed the demographics and therefore the politics of the nation, which was the objective. In the background of this, was, of course, was this budding civil rights movement. It started right after World War II, really during World War II, because you had some legislation passed that wasn't enforced regarding, you know, certain contracts and employment for blacks in the munition factories and in the army. After World War II, the armed forces were desegregated. Prior to that, they were segregated. So you had that. But in the 1950s, you had the sort of this rise of Martin Luther King. And this was a response to the protests in Selma and the Birmingham. Of course, you had Rosa Parks, her protest with the buses, and you had the boycott, the Birmingham bus boycott. And it really started to gain traction in the late 1950s, largely because of favorable press treatment in the North. You know, that was very critical of the South, or in many cases rightly so, for the some of the Jim Crow laws, segregation laws in the South. So you had this agitation in the South, and you had some weak civil rights legislation passed in the early 60s under the Kennedy administration, but still, really, the watershed event was the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, under Lyndon Johnson, who succeeded JFK when he was assassinated. And what happened was JFK or LBJ used the death of Kennedy to push through that bill, that law. And that law itself, while many praised as sort of being sacrosanct and much needed legislation, it's very problematic because much of the law itself, from a constitutional standpoint, is very dubious. Particularly, it's the provisions banning employment discrimination in the private sector. And this, what happened was, in order to justify this, the Supreme Court invoked the Interstate Commerce Clause to say that Congress could regulate employment practices of private employers. And that's also violating the concept of voluntary association and voluntary contract. But there's no provision in the Constitution for Congress to do that, but they read the Interstate Commerce Clause rather broadly to justify this. And this also had had a precedent in the during the New Deal with the Wicker v. Filburn decision, which said that Congress could prevent a farmer from using his wheat to feed his grain to feed his livestock because it affected interstate commerce. So it was a broad, more or less, through that interpretation, the Congress was pretty much, the Supreme Court was pretty much trashing the idea of delegated and enumerated powers, and pretty much under the rubric of interstate commerce, Congress do whatever it wanted. And that's how the Civil Rights Legislation Act was justified from a constitutional standpoint. And of course, then it eventually inevitably led to the creation of racial quotas and affirmative action, because in order to enforce the employment section of the Civil Rights Act, the courts determined eventually, I think in the 1970s, that statistical disparity in employment was a prima facie case of racial discrimination in any suit or in any complaint brought, regardless of other conditions or other circumstances that may lead to a disparity in, between the races and in employment. So that led many companies to implement racial quotas in hiring, particularly in government contracts. And there's
any company that had government contract, but also, they were basically, everywhere there just became quotas because of the threat of lawsuits in this area.
Mm-hmm. And also, big in government employment and government contracts because, as the federal government expanded, it became that much more in the 1960s with contracting. Companies became more and more dependent on federal contracts. They themselves have to comply with these standards in order to compete for federal contracts.
I remember in a software company, we were small, but we thought we could apply for a DoD contract. And the application form basically had us describe the racial composition of the company. And then if there were no blacks, we had to kind of explain why that was.
Yeah.
It was just a burden that was placed on almost every business in America.
It also became an opportunity for for a shakedown because outfits like Jesse Jackson's CORE, is it not CORE? Is it Rainbow Coalition? Rainbow Coalition, yeah. Would go to companies and say, if you don't donate to to us, we might have to start protesting. And they wouldn't really care who was employed. They just use it as a threat to get donations from the company. Or they get, good example, I think Jesse Jackson's son got the sole distributorship for Anheuser-Busch, where he lived.
Yeah, I mean, basically none of the companies could comply with the kind of vague criteria that led to lawsuits, let alone the kind of vague, criteria that were in the laws that they were supposed to adhere to, because they're just during the transition, and I don't think even today, particularly in technical areas, you just couldn't find people that you really wanted to hire, put money into, because that kind of education just wasn't being given to African American males and women.
They simply weren't there to hire.
Just didn't exist. And it's not to say they didn't have a reason for this, but it just in terms of being a, you know, in a business, it was just completely chaos. You know, I wanted to mention that when they began the process of weaponized integration, they found a willing audience for movement from the South, because that cohort of African Americans had never actually been free of slavery. After the Civil War, the states in that area basically changed the laws of the penitentiary to include chain gangs, which could then be rented out to government and but also to individuals. Mm-hmm. So this condition lasted right up to World War II. And so you can imagine, you know, if suddenly someone shows up and says, you know, how would you like to get away from the chain gang and come up to, you know, Detroit or, you know, Philadelphia, and there's manufacturing employment up here. So the process began, and in my opinion, it was completely weaponized. I mean, the target was really sort of the family, and in order to atomize the ethnic societies, they had to have some reason to push them from the cities out into the suburbs, where they would be deracinated, right, where the ethnic communities wouldn't exist any longer. And if you think about it, it's really almost absurd, because the cities in 1950 were integrated, right? Mm-hmm. You could drive around Chicago, L.A., and you would see there were blacks and white European ethnicities living side by side all over the place. But they were very partitioned, right? Mm-hmm. They had separate schools, and this was really the most important component of the integration that was occurring at that time, is that the ethnicities felt safe in their areas because they had their own schools, so that the children could be based, you know, sequestered from any kind of danger that the parents saw from other ethnicities. When that was blown out, and when there was the forced integration, that was when, you know, the integration that had existed for basically since America had began was destroyed. And you started having true segregation, whereas, in a lot of the cities, the populations which had been integrated, suddenly the white component just fell off a cliff. And what was left basically was African Americans in many areas. Mm-hmm. This was supposedly the integrated America that they were attempting to bring about by forcing the school children to, you know, go to schools that were not close by where their parents lived. It was preposterous, and it was obviously a weapon. There's simply no way in my mind that the people who created the policy could have been unaware of what the consequences are going to be. So this is a really important part of American history to try to understand, is that the African Americans in the 50s were given basically another workers' paradise story, right? Now, they had every reason to be susceptible to the story because of racism, because of slavery, because of poverty, because of the chain gang. I mean, they had every reason to actually be ready for a worker's paradise. But at the same time, progress had been made from the Civil War right up until the Civil Rights Movement that was positive in virtually every African-American community. All of the demographics were going good. Education was on the uptick. Every subsequent generation was more educated. Income, while it was nowhere near parity with whites, it was closing in, and it was on the uptick. And the family demographics were improving. There was less and less children being born out of wedlock. It's hard to get statistics. What I can find indicates that even all the health numbers were getting better. in all of these inner cities, which is very easy to understand, Tim, because if you just think of, I mean, you know, Detroit or Chicago, the African-American community is separate from the ethnic communities that are around it, Polish, Italian, German, Irish, but they're benefiting from the relationship. There's a tax base, right, mm-hmm. that they all share. And they have local control over their schools, right? It isn't some bureaucrat at the in the state with a, you know, a social agenda. They have much more control at this point. So now comes the civil rights movement, right? Which, of course, has as its, you know, it's kind of its logo, Rosa Parks, right? Where in the South, you know, you have the segregation of eating areas. And so this is basically used to begin this movement that would create a political will, or at least a political cover, for the great deintegration of America. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny in that, and it's just so common, though, in history. You know, the Russian proletariats are sitting there with the Tsar, and along come the Bolsheviks and offer the workers paradise. And it looks good on paper. Political power is given to the Bolsheviks. And the next thing you know, Holodomor, right, where millions and millions of people are being killed. Well, here in the United States, it's a parallel, because they were, you know, the African-Americans are being promised that this is going to be good. The liberal Americans who are sympathetic to their causes are promised that there's going to be an improvement. But from the very day that the Great Society programs came into effect, the demographics of misery all turn against the African American and against Europeans. So I say it was a weapon.
Yeah, that's with the you had the, this sort of this decline or collapse of the black family in the 1960s, just when this, the Great Society is kicking in, along with the civil rights movement. And so they're being offered this promise of salvation through the political process and through government aid, the federal government. Although to look to the federal government to help required a very, very, I think, short or incomplete view of history, because if you look through throughout history in the United States, the federal government had not really been friendly to blacks. I mean, if you look at slavery itself, was defended by the Constitution. It was only when the South seceded from the Union that slavery was in jeopardy, ironically. Yeah. Otherwise, the federal government was obligated to protect it. Dred Scott was a federal court decision. U.S. Supreme Court was a federal court. Plessy v. Ferguson, federal court, these things. And, of course, not many blacks were helped by the invasion of the Union Army into the South, which led to the death and starvation of, you know, tens of thousands of civilians, including blacks, the destruction of the Southern economy. But then, you know, they go in under Reconstruction and they rob the place blind. You know, the scalawags and the carpetbaggers, even the Freedmen's Bureau was a scam, where the money was taken. But after Reconstruction, even if you buy into the myth of Reconstruction, the North just left and left the blacks to fend for themselves. Root hog, as Lincoln said.
The chain South. Gang.
Yeah, then you had the chain gang, you had Jim Crow, and they did nothing for them up until the 1960s. So they step in just at the very time that the Civil Rights Movement is gaining traction and pose as the savior. All the time using that movement as an excuse to seize more power, because, again, like I said, the interpretation of the Constitution to justify the so-called civil rights legislation was creating more or less unlimited federal power and destroying what remained of delegated and enumerated powers of the Constitution, all under the cover of freedom and civil rights and democracy, which is an old...
Exactly.
You know, they were hoodwinked. Exactly
right. Yeah, I mean, civil rights was used to... it was a Swiss Army knife of destruction. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was decimated were the powers and protections that individual had from the Constitution. Mm-hmm. because suddenly you have this overarching and amorphous legal principle that just trumped everything. And now the idea of self-determination, including the public schools that your children went to, No, it's going to be some federal judge.
Yeah, no more local control. And now something as problematic as the 14th Amendment, you had the going further back, you know, a century before the Civil Rights Movement, but the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, were very problematic, particularly the 14th Amendment, because basically what the federal government said to the states was, in order to be a union, in order to rejoin the union, you have to amend these, you have to ratify these amendments. But then again, only states can ratify the amendments. So here you're getting sort of the circular logic or the illogic or the contradictions inherent in the American so-called American Civil War, at least its legal basis. That's why Lincoln had to invoke the mystic cords of memory to justify his war. He couldn't really invoke the law because the law was against him.
I simplify it and just say people should understand the Civil War as a population reduction.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really what was in back, but they just wanted to shatter Christian European culture.
Yeah, and it got so bad with the 14th Amendment.
It was Masonic. You can actually, there's pictures of Grant and Sherman looking for an obelisk in Egypt.
Yeah.
After the war, trying to so they can come back and then commemorate the Sherman's March to the Sea, which had no military function at all, but was just a way to decimate population.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a Masonic, and of course that just replaces one mystery with another. You know, you need to get to the bottom of what is that? What is that? And what do we mean by that? But it was certainly a Masonic project, and slavery was just, again, that was the workers' paradise. And the you mentioned the fact that the Union left shortly after the end of the war, which just shows how absurd the cover story of ending slavery was. They came in for just a few months, basically pillaged, and then when there was nothing left, they all left.
Mm-hmm.
And then then everything just reverted to form. Of course, now you had the Ku Klux Klan. The European populations were extremely radicalized, and the African American, that which supposedly was going to benefit from this gigantic human slaughter, he was just left to fend for themselves.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's a book called Emancipating Slaves and Enslaving Freemen. It talks about, really, at the outset of the Civil War, you had what they called the Gulf State Confederacy, the first secession in the fall of 1860, early winter 1861. It was called the Gulf State Confederacy. And these were the deep states, Confederate states that left, the southern states that had left. But really, in order to get the Civil War, you needed Virginia to secede, and you needed Tennessee to secede, and you needed North Carolina to secede. And they only seceded in reaction to Lincoln's call up for the troops to invade the South. But other than that, if you wanted slavery to end without the protection of the federal government, there's no way those border states could have ever maintained slavery, because.
Well, it's really interesting, and I just don't believe that, just on a objective level, that the 50 years in front of the African American in the slave states would have been anywhere near as catastrophic as the 50 years that they faced from the war forward.
Oh, no, because the war was so catastrophic.
It was catastrophic. Yeah. It destroyed the economy. They became vastly poor. And one slave state was replaced with another with the chain gang approach. And so it had been, as it turns out, just a bill of goods. I think then when the civil rights legislation led to the Great Society programs, and they were a 1-2 punch, because the Civil Rights, the Voting Act, basically created a template for lawsuits, and they could just bludgeon any small community or any small business, right,
mm-hmm.
with a threat of a lawsuit once that thing had come into effect. They could certainly shatter all of the school districts if they wanted to. So, you know, that was one legal power that, you know, really damaged the African-American community. But this was also when they began the Great Society welfare situation. And this has to be focused upon, because now African-American women who had a husband or a man living with them weren't eligible for the same benefits. And that simple little trick started to shift the demographics that had been going positive for almost 100 years, negative. And once they turned south quickly, because at the same time, drugs were starting to be introduced, in my opinion, by the government, the same group that is bringing about the welfare state destruction. They start introducing drugs. This is when you start seeing the inner city as a basically the place where hard drugs can be purchased. It starts with heroin, but quickly gets into marijuana and cocaine. And, you know, by the 70s, it's just full throttle. And Hollywood, of course, is supporting this concept with movies, these pimp movies that glorify the heroic struggle of the African-American male to be a drug dealer, you know.
Yeah, that's his way of getting back at the system.
yeah, exactly, you know. And, of course, you know, sexual integration. They're trying to promote white women, you know, as like the benefits of integration, right? And of course, this is not exactly helping African American family production in their communities, is it? And see, all of this is in my opinion just obviously designed. I think the idea that it was just a bad social policy that somehow wiped out an entire culture. No, I don't think so. I don't think that's very likely.
Yeah. So you mentioned the black exploitation films that were produced in the early 70s, late 60s. Of course, that was directed by Time Life. There's Gordon Parks, who directed those. He was a Time Life photographer, also helped infiltrate the Black Panthers and set them up to be murdered. Freddie Hampton.
Bizarre character. Yeah.
He directed those movies as a cultural weapon, because that was with MGM, James Aubrey, who was working with the CIA to produce those films. And this followed just after what was called the breakup of the Black Jewish Alliance over the teachers' strike in New York. And this was, you know, this alliance had formed in the wake of the Leo Frank trial in Atlanta, when this Jewish guy had raped and murdered a 15-year-old girl, Mary Fagan. And that was when the Jewish community declared war in the South, and anti-Semitism became a problem in the South. It didn't exist prior to that. It was a reaction to the media's coverage of this trial of this man who, by all accounts, was guilty of this murder of this young girl, who tried to frame two black men, by the way. But he was the local head of B'nai B'rith. And out of B'nai B'rith, we got the ADL. And the ADL was a creation, a reaction to the Leo Frank trial, because his sentence was commuted, and he was subsequently lynched and murdered, right outside Mary Fagan's house as a message. By the locals.
Right. I think that, just backing up for 1 second to clarify, I think that Audrey's participation in the black exploitation film is critical for people to understand, because that's a direct link into secret society. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a CIA asset. He was running Gordon Parks, as far as anyone can tell. I've seen some, you know, reasonable conjecture about that. And his, why would, again, it's sort of like the CIA's connection into Gloria Steinem, is that the question arises, why is the CIA mucking around in culture?
Yes.
You know, this is just in and of itself is wrong. And the reason why it has to be secret is because there's something evil afoot, something that the public must be kept from, right? There was no other explanation for it. So when you get evidence that the CIA is like you know, creating these obviously debasing films, right? You now can plug it into the context of like Gordon Wasson's MK Ultra pay requisitions.
Mm-hmm.
You see, suddenly the pattern starts to become clear. There is an organization controlling the CIA. They're using it to basically turn American culture into a debased situation whereby the family is destroyed and the individuals are isolated so they can be easily to control or do with them what they want. And when you understand that, then the whole history of America starts to make, from the end of World War II to today, makes sense. You know, suddenly it becomes really clear. And then just one other point, you have Gloria Steinem, the CIA agent, Ms. Magazine, the CIA cutout, right? This now can be documented. I mean, this has all been exposed. Very easy for a normal person to go through the information. We did a show on it with mm-hmm. a lot of the details in this. Okay, so you can see they're messing around with culture. They're debasing it. They're trying to break apart the family. But bear in mind that Ms. Magazine is where Black Macho, the myth of the superwoman, of the Black superwoman, comes from. This was the most vicious hit piece on the African-American male that had ever been created. It was created supposedly by this young African-American woman, Michelle Wallace, who then later admitted that, well, actually, I was breastfed the book by, I believe it's Marilyn Johnson, who is a Masonic cesspool in terms of her background. She's with Allen Ginsberg and Kerouac. And then her son is Daniel Pinchbeck, the current proponent of LSD, right? Mm-hmm. Now, once you get the context correct, right, you go, okay, well, I see what they're doing. The CIA is creating a debased culture. They're going after the African-Americans. They're creating the fantasy of the workers' paradise. Then you look at Black Macho. Well, it's one of those things that just becomes crystal clear, doesn't it? I mean, suddenly you go, okay, that was just another element in the shattering of the African-American community, and clearly it's coming from whichever group is controlling the CIA. They had the idea that they would shatter the African-American culture absolutely. Why are they doing it? They African-American at that point represented a very small political risk to the oligarchs.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to integrate it, you see. They want to have the pimp culture and the rap music culture be what they shove the children from the deracinated white suburbs into.
Mm-hmm.
See the plan?
Yep.
This is Miley Cyrus, right? This is where you end up, is you know, basically a level of bestiality, because there you have a population that is incapable of defending itself. It has no cultural future or strength.
Yeah, this was what the book, the White Negro, and the idea of spade kicks, promoting
was that Norman?
The Mailer, yeah,
mm-hmm.
and celebrating the supposed freedom, you know, the sexual license that was common among certain segments of the Black community, particularly the jazz music and musicians, these things, but highlighting that behavior and stereotyping that behavior, then promoting it.
Yeah, I mean, he was just saying what a hip thing it is for a white person to mimic, you know, a pimp.
Yeah,
and of course, this was exactly what they were trying to do. And Mailer is obviously just a cutout from the organization. He's just a sickening individual. But anyway, so yeah, he creates that and you know, other, you know, culturally debasing memes. But the White Negro was really, you know, that's just a very clear point in this whole process where cues are given through, I think, through athletic heroes, through success with drug sales. You know, the pimp advertises his wealth, you know, with fancy cars and fancy clothes. And then you have, you know, the integration that's coming from the music world. And so what happens now to the culture that had existed inside America's cities in the 50s that had gotten pushed out to the suburbs. Now you can see the whole plan in its, you know, with clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Because those kids couldn't really, they were very susceptible. The media was going to be promoting all of these elements, the blaxploitation films, you know, Shaft, the stuff like this. The debased American, African-American would become an idol and a role model for the white, deracinated young people.
Mm-hmm. And you've pointed the coordination between the American Jewish Committee and MKUltra, that's CIA.
Yeah. In
promoting this, because of course they targeted the family, particularly the Christian family, particularly the father figure, as being the source of fascism in the United States, and the way you undermine
authoritarian
that,
personality.
Yeah, the authoritarian personality.
I mean, even the name of the project tells you what they're up to, because you know when you the idea that an authoritarian personality was something that was you know seen as evil, something that was psychologically distinct and needed to be changed through hidden psychological techniques that were using Eros, mm-hmm. right? Well, gee whiz, I think that maybe a father needs to have some authoritarian structure. Wouldn't you, Tim? I mean, you know, wouldn't this oftentimes be something that was valuable and good for a family?
Yeah, they want to turn families into democracies. How Masonic. get rid of the patriarch and you know what do you have you know and so I mean you have that type of malevolence being coordinated by the foundations by the media corporations by Hollywood and the music and you see it's everywhere and it's also by governmental policy the destruction of local communities through integration under the name of racial integration. But if you destroy the ethnic base of a community, you destroy that community, and the people are just left with nothing. They become deracinated, and all they have to really have in common is, you know, what they're consuming. And that's how you create the consumer culture.
You know what, Jim? I mean, like, we don't even have to, like, use metaphors or language. We could just get in an Uber and drive through a city and show the effects of all of this, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I was in Detroit. My Uber driver, the GPS didn't work. We ended up going through all kinds of the city of Detroit that basically has homes that are not inhabited, at least not on the tax roll. So you can just see it, right? Mm-hmm. You can see it wasn't just the manufacturing base left. It was that the culture debased. The culture wasn't able to regenerate itself. There was no wealth that could be created from a culture that had as its main source of income welfare and drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just there's just nothing that anyone could do from that position. And, you know, this is really evil on an incredible scale. I mean, Tim, this is evil on an incredible scale. This is like an acid test where they bring the, you know, white teenagers and give them LSD for free, mm-hmm. right? That kind of evil where, I mean, it's beyond evil because basically it's a bifurcation. It's the group that is producing the event, the culture, looks upon the other section of the population that it's attacking as is inhuman as animals, and these are animals that you can basically torture, you can kill, you can do anything you want to, because they are not human. They are not. When you look at the acid tests, you're looking at a program that is put out by a group that looks at these teenagers as inhuman. When you look at the Great Society programs and the social engineering that went on against the African Americans, this was created by a group that looked at these people as inhuman. They didn't have any human rights in the minds of the people organizing this. They couldn't have, right? And these are individuals with great psychological technique, Right. Look at the psychological technique expertise in the American Jewish Committee putting out the authoritarian personality. Mm-hmm. Look at the psychological expertise in the Macy Conference. Look at the psychological expertise in MKUltra. Right. Look at that. Read through the list of the pay requisition for the projects and look at the projects that are going. Look how specific they are. Right. So, you know, it isn't just that there is a secret society that has taken control of the political and financial and military. It's that they have a perspective on humanity that basically is it is almost unique in its evil in the perspective of those who are not inside the guild. I mean, Tim, they would kill every one of us to retain their control. They would kill every one of us just to have another day of power for whatever purpose they are. And this is why you've got to start to organize yourself. You've got to do it. People who listen to our shows and get what we're saying, I know it's difficult, right? I know you're atomized. I know you don't have the social connections that would make this automatic or easy. Doesn't matter. You're a father to start to try to defend your children through organization.
Yeah, well, you have to start to
defend yourself against.
Stop acquiescing to it. Stop supporting it.
Well, you're dealing with basically psychopaths that have the political control and are circling around you,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is our, you know, I mean, sorry to bring any bad news, but there it is. You know, when you go through the civil rights situation, you get to a very clear point. You just say, you know something? This group is just murderous to the, you know, I mean, to the point where that doesn't, murder doesn't matter to anybody.
Yeah.
They don't care.
But the big problem with that is if you critique the civil rights movement as weaponized human rights or some, you know, social engineering scheme.
Well, you're a racist.
You're a racist. And this is part of the reason why figures like Martin Luther King were promoted and then assassinated. Because in his martyrdom, he serves the system much better. Because they'll name streets after him, they'll name libraries and schools after him, they'll build monuments to him after they arranged for his murder. But he was always a tool of the establishment.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In my opinion, the same guys that made him, you know, a figurehead who promoted him. I mean, I think he's a legitimate guy.
Yeah, but unwitting.
But he would have been someone who no one would have known about. Except the group decided to promote this individual. They had a reason for doing this. They wanted basically to create marches. Mm-hmm. Remember the marches? Because this they could then use as media phenomena to justify what was coming, the civil rights legislation and the welfare state. So this was what King's role was just to be a figurehead for the movement that would create the publicity that was the cover story. And of course, they were going to, you know, on the mountain kind of speeches that he would give were ideal because it was promoting the idea of the workers' paradise,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the African American wouldn't think about, well, what does it really mean to have the government, the state, be the source of income, right?
Yeah, because
let me tell you something. Yeah. I'm just going to say, I'm sorry to be a long one, but just the African-American was very self-reliant, very similar to, say, like Latino families in the United States today, because their tradition, who've immigrated from Mexico, because they come from poverty and they mm-hmm. survive poverty on their own. So they are extremely self-reliant and ingenious in terms of like how they can, you know, keep themselves intact and fed and in real crisis, these people would probably survive better than middle-class individuals because they have these skills.
Yeah, they have survival skills.
Disappeared, right? The self-reliance skill set that the African-Americans had generated through slavery, through the chain gang, through the Jim Crow, through all of the trials that the community had faced, that all was given up when the welfare state came into town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a figure like King, who's presenting himself and I think believes himself to be someone challenging the system, As each stage, each step he's taking, he's advocating more government power.
Right. You know. So he's being influenced. There's no question. Influenced.
And he was, I mean, he was, his handler was Stanley Levinson, who say wrote the letters from Birmingham jail. He sent him up north in Chicago in 1966. It was a failure because he had no idea what was going on in Chicago. He was from the South. The problems in Chicago were different from the problems in the South. There, you know, he was paid to go up there and cause trouble and break up the ethnic, try to break up the Italian and some of the Lithuanian neighborhoods up there. And, you know, people saying, you know, they were being called racist and all that stuff. And white, and says, I'm not white, I'm Lithuanian, you know.
Yeah.
He got that in Chicago. Someone threw a brick at him. He never went back, hit him in the head. But, you know, it's interesting because he's since his murder, he's been canonized a secular saint. And, of course, the problems surrounding his assassination are well known. You know, obviously, it wasn't James Earl Ray that did it. Most likely, based on people's research, it was a sharpshooter with the Memphis Police Department. There also was a sniper division in the city too. On hand,
there's some
backup.
Yeah,
there's
about, it's sort of like, yeah, you know, 911 or the JFK. Yeah. When you get to it, it's just, I was very depressed. I started to research into it, and it looked really clear to me like the guy had been just taken out, and it was sad to see that. But one thing I got pretty quick was that this James Earl Ray guy was just a,
no way.
You know, just not, this is not the guy who did it.
Yeah, this lawyer tells him to plead guilty to avoid death penalty, and don't worry, you'll be able to get out of it because I'm sick. Inadequate defense, and they never give him a retrial. You know, the King family also is official. You know, they had that trial, the civil proceeding in the late 90s that concluded it was a conspiracy. But of course, at that time, King started to criticize the Vietnam War, and that seemed to be might have why he was taken out.
You know, I mean, who knows what their schedules are, they are trying to do. But he was clearly created as a hero, an Elvis of the civil rights movement.
Yeah,
you can see this in the handlers, and you can see this in the purported creation of literature, mm-hmm. which I've tried to research. I'm not certain about it, but it looks to me like it's pretty likely. And that would be your tip, right? That this is just a cutout, and then when you put him in the right context. See, this is the thing. This is why, you know, this overall context and why the fingerprints are so important to understand. You know, the Gordon Wasson pay requisition, Gloria Steinem CIA admission. I just could go on for, you know, like half hour. But the things that are identifiable, you know, that people can look at and go, gee whiz, okay, this, they create a context. You can see, hey, in World War II, they start ratcheting up psychological techniques to control population, and what are they going to do with it? Well, they're just going to create the debased culture we have today. So we start plugging these things in to that overall structure, and then suddenly history makes perfect sense.
Well, that's
suddenly
right. Yeah, because Bateson, his idea of weaponized anthropology, there's a book by that title, right? I forget who coined that term.
Yeah, David Price. He exposed.
But that was Bateson's work in the South Pacific, is how you manipulate or control primitive cultures.
Exactly.
And of course,
this is. But then is it? And he's writing that to the head of the OSS on how to create a better slave system, and talking about an archaic revival, basically, as like you want to take him out of technology. This is what led to the hippie movement, mm-hmm. But it also is what led to rap music, right? Mm-hmm. So everything that. And then, of course, if you turn your TV set on, you can watch Naked and Afraid, mm-hmm. Mountain Men, Dual Survivors. I mean, there's just now, it's like round-the-clock conditioning for a post-electric world for the European, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just every show you turn on, the most absurd is Naked and Afraid, which is just, I mean, how anyone could imagine this other being anything other than just brainwashing is beyond me, but... Anyway, when you put it in the context, right, when you start with Bateson's letter, which indicates how to create a slave state through basically cultural debasement, you see Bateson being basically the founder of the CIA. Little known fact, there's different people who can you can give the title to reasonably, and people say Truman because he funded it, or Donovan. But in fact, Truman and Donovan couldn't agree on funding the thing. And Donovan went and got Bateson, who then made the argument that Truman accepted, which is that, you know, hey, we've got nuclear bombs now. How are we going to control the people except through psychological means? This was the founding of the CIA. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with Cold War or any kind of international skullduggery. It was, we have to study to figure out how to control the populations because we can't. It's going to be harder and harder to use war to reduce populations, to shatter culture because of the bomb, right? So now the CIA comes along, and what do you get out of the CIA? Well, the first thing is MKUltra, mm-hmm. right? So from the very beginning, you've got a secret society with the power of government that is studying how to control people, and that's why when you look at Audrey's handling of Gordon Parks, which you very alertly brought up, man, you're looking right into the face of it. You're looking right into the face of it. This is what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And they are... important aspect of the civil rights movement was how racial and also sexual discrimination was added into it by a senator seeking to derail the bill. But after two hours of debate, they passed sex-based discrimination being just as illegal. And this sets the legal stage for the feminist movement and the agitation and the litigation and the hysteria we're seeing now with sexual harassment. And all the cottage legal industries that are developed around it, sensitivity training programs, these things, some of these things are just nonsense, and and there's a lot of money being made, a lot of lawsuits, and this also creates more division between the sexes. It's not there to resolve anything. At the same time, they're promoting a culture, a debased, highly sexualized culture, which guarantees that women are going to be treated.
Well, exactly. Women think that, like, sort of middle class males are the problem. Look, it's Miley Cyrus.
Yeah.
It's Hollywood. This is what is debasing the males. If I was a college white or African American female, I would be terrified of these males.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're watching pornography around the clock, right?
Yeah,
what do you think someone who's 19 years old who has watched 1,000 hours of pornography thinks is going to happen in the courtship procedure, Tim?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't it clear that this individual has no capacity for relationships, really? I mean, don't you think this pornographic conditioning is going to affect the individual? And won't, if you have alcohol and drugs, then sexual abuse will be likely to occur, right? Yeah. Okay, well, this is the damn problem. It's not because we don't have laws. It's because we don't have culture. You know, this is what they have to look at. So, you know...
the Supreme Court facilitated that with the Roth decision, which destroyed... the power of local communities to police things like pornography.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, people talk of, they want all these, all these political correctness stuff. Get rid of the Roth decision. Get rid of the legal structures that created the pornographic culture, and get rid of the financial incentive that creates single moms. And you're going to have a culture that people will feel defended inside of,
mm-hmm.
right? The laws are not going to help you. You can have all the laws you want if you're a co-ed and you're with some debased, drunken male who's 19 years old, who's been like 2,000 hours of pornography, right? Well,
yeah, look at the college campuses. They create these Dionysian atmosphere. And then they have these strict codes, these almost Victorian codes.
It's just there
to create conflict.
They're there to
create
conflict, exactly.
It's ridiculous.
It's just there to create chaos. And then they're, of course, the way they're going to deal with the chaos is through just give up every single right you have as an individual.
Yeah, like presumption of innocence.
We'll protect you from sexual predation. Just give up your freedom to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, it's the old thing, you know, they always have the worker's paradise, the woman's paradise, the paradise for the African American. They always have the paradise. It's always being shown to them and in concept. And all you have to do is give this little group that's running everything just a little more political power, just a little bit more. We'll get it all right. But every time that happens, then, you know, the culture gets more and more debased and more people are basically killed. The saddest thing is the Holodomor. You know, I've been doing a lot of research into it lately, and this is just so parallel to what happened, in my opinion, like to the African-American community and to the hippies. The workers' paradise is presented. The Bolsheviks, though, were just kidding.
Yeah.
As soon as you give them political power, oh, my God, look what they're doing. And so for the African-Americans, you know, they traded their self-reliance, or they were fooled, basically. They were clever propaganda. They weren't to blame. You know, it was sophistry. They were a clever argument was created. They were saying, hey, look, affirmative action is going to give you more job opportunities and welfare to the single mother will protect your poorest parts of the community.
Yeah. I asked the question, are Black Americans better off now? And I emailed to you, and the question was, you know, are voting rights more important than having a family? What really determines your quality of life and how you develop? Voting is largely an empty gesture. You're voting for Tweedledee and Tweedledum, whoever the oligarchs decide to give you, the choice to give you. And, if you don't have the benefit of a mother and a father and a family and a community and cousins and a neighbor that you identify with, I mean, the political process is empty.
It's absurd. You know, the best indication of basically up or down in the misery index for the African-American community is death by heroin overdose. Mm-hmm. Because that really tells you what is going on in the street, how many more people are forced into finding an oblivion to escape, you know, miserable reality. Do you know what happened to that statistic under the African-American hero Obama? It went up 400%. Right. Oh, my gosh. How did that happen?
Afghanistan?
How did an African-American president
end
up creating conditions where inside the African-American community you had death by heroin overdose go up 400%, the largest percent increase it's just off the chart. It's like 5 standard deviations, you know, from so this during a time when Obama, who was there to help the African-American community, decided, you know what I need to do? I need to invade Afghanistan.
Yep.
Yeah, I got to go into Afghanistan. Oh, I see. So you're going to put 150,000 troops into Afghanistan, no money into the African-American communities. And then somehow, Tim, just some amazing way, all of the heroin, all the opium, the poppies from Afghanistan ends up in our street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a second. Wait a second. I thought didn't we take control of Afghanistan? How come heroin is so cheap?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that lucrative drug market is key to, well, a lot of things. The money has to be laundered somewhere.
They use it for off balance sheet funding, but I don't think at this point that's an issue anymore, because now the financial situation is so completely absurd. They can just print money.
Oh, I know.
I think if someone actually did a real audit of the American government financial system, it would just be like 20 times more debt is being created. You don't even know about money's just they're just stealing everything. They're fine. I mean, it's just a complete free for all at this point, which is going to face plant eventually. But hopefully people will understand, you know, what happened. But, you know, getting back to your question, you know, it's such a great question, because it really puts on the table you have to take steps to get out of. If you're, you know, I mean, I presume that there are a lot of individuals inside the inner city, African-American whites, you know, they're looking out at the rap world, pornographic culture, the poverty, you know, the lack of jobs, and they're, you know, and of course the drug trade is just everywhere, and they're wondering what the hell to do, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, can, you know, voting for Obama didn't really work, did it? Right. No. The Masonic, you know, double cross was just too easy. All they needed was a half black guy to, you know, step on with a big smile on his face, and everybody thought everything was going to get better. But if you create a real family, or if you can't do it, if you can support a family, just go to them and say, you know, I really want, you know, you're having children. I'm your friend. What can I do to help you? I want to help a family, organize families. This is what you're going to have to do. And you're going to have to do it in with the full force of the pornographic media and the drug trade coming right at you every single second. You're, what you really need to do inside the inner cities is to promote two things, strength and virtue, right? Forget the drugs business, the pornography. Just realize that was all done to destroy you. And how are you going to fight back? You got to fight back, first of all, by recognizing changes and promotion of character traits that, that are going to make you get back on the right path. This is the same thing I say to the victims of, you know, hippiedom. Mm-hmm. Say, look, you know, you just got to get out of the Grateful Dead, you know, structure, and you got to think about how to promote strength of character, you know, and virtue, because that's from there you can think about maybe a family.
Yes, and start from there, a basis, at least a firm yeah. foundation for growth. There's an article I came across when I was researching this topic, that, but it's called it was titled "How the 1964 Civil Rights Act Made Racial Group Entitlements Inevitable," but there's a part of it that I found particularly relevant to what we're talking about here.
If I can get
it. It's a little lengthy, so if you bear with me.
Oh, go, no, please. I'm just, I'm very curious about this.
Okay. First, let me get a sip of water. Okay. I thought it was this, it's by Lawrence Oster, and he, I think he worded it well. To criticize the profound harm done to our society by the civil rights movement and its aftermath is not to defend all of the South's pre-civil rights racial policies. For example, the Jim Crow laws, which not only allowed discrimination against blacks, but mandated it, most notoriously in public accommodation, were an offense to the nation's conscience and would have had to be eliminated in one way or another. But the regime brought into being by the civil rights, 1964 Civil Rights Act, did not stop correcting specific racial injustices, just as those that came under Jim Crow, but attacking in principle all racial discrimination, including private racial discrimination, it in effect delegitimized all natural historic human groupings and cultures. If they were white, it delegitimized white people's most basic rights of free association and of property, since such rights were now seen as having only one end in view, the oppression of blacks. And as pointed out above, it said that whites and the white's entire history as the American majority was a scandal. The ongoing functional and economic deficiencies in the black community were seen as a result of the same historic white sin, which thus seemed to be still operative in the present as well as the past. Pro-individual right conservatives have always harked back to the dream of Martin Luther King, the golden age of race-blind society that was portrayed by Affirmative Action. But the golden age never existed. The dream is literally a dream, and proved by brute fact that minority racial preferences were instituted almost the instant the Civil 1964 Act was passed, the epitome of racial blind society idea. Furthermore, not only did the race blind society never exist, it cannot exist. This is an important point. This is because an America that declares itself to be not just race blind government, and legal system, which is both right and possible within reasonable limits, but a race-blind society can only do so by outlawing the group consciousness on the part of the racial majority, which delegitimizes the majority culture and ethos, which in turn liberates and validates the group consciousness and will to power of minorities, which then begin to tear society apart. And that, I think that's something that the secret society recognized. The act made it impossible for the white majority to lead America while it transformed blacks into sacred victims whose clamoring for group equality of results could not in good conscience be opposed. These are group power dynamics that underlie the transformation of civil rights into a permanent system of racial privileges for blacks and other minorities in this country. Yet, as alluded to above, during the several decades of this controversy, mainstream conservatives seem to have believed that if they just kept invoking the ever more disregarded principle of individual rights, the principle, like an autonomous being, would somehow spring back to life and become once again the law of the land. This was a fantasy born of the neoconservative view of America as a set of abstract ideas. The reality is quite different. In order for society to maintain its principles, it must have actual people who are ready, willing, and able to defend those principles. An America whose historic white majority has been stripped of its moral legitimacy lacks such people. Here we go. Here's the final paragraph. The proper sphere of race-blind equality is in the state's dealings with individual citizens. Government and law must not discriminate by race, but the same does not apply to society. Society consists of human beings, and a race is a part of what human beings are, just as sex and family and nationality and religion are part of what human beings are. Therefore, society cannot be made race-blind any more than it can be made sex-blind or family-blind or nationality-blind or religion-blind. The cost of trying to do so is the destruction of the legitimate liberty and cultural particularity upon which human beings flourish, upon which human flourishing depends. There you go. So I thought that was excellent.
I mean, it's absolutely right. The fact is that we are not less race blind. We are more race conscious because of all of this legislation.
Yeah.
I don't think any of the paranoia between races is been diminished one iota. I would go so far to say that anyone who makes a claim is simply either a liar or an idiot, because you can just go to 1950, look at the statistics, look at the newspaper, and just see how much racial paranoia you're looking at, and then compare them to what's going on today.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1,000 to 1. I mean, the ethnic communities of a truly integrated city, like, say, Detroit or Philadelphia in 1950-55, they didn't worry that much about violence from other ethnicities, because frankly they were very powerful. No one could really you just couldn't walk into these neighborhoods and think you could get away with something.
Because
they have to defend themselves.
Yeah, like you tell that story with the ethnic consciousness, there's accountability. You have community there. You have people watching the street. They all know each other. So there's accountability, familiarity, these things. You don't have the anonymity. So even within these huge cities, you had communities where people weren't autonomized, and there was local communities within these cities. So you had that benefit that you might get even in a small, this sort of idealized small town.
I mean, the saddest thing that you can see is these videos where you have a group of police beating an individual, almost always African-American. I just think in the 50s, you just couldn't beat up individuals in lots of communities. I think, sad to say, the African-American was a community where there was a tradition of it. But even there, I think they were able to defend themselves far better than they can now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the problem is now that the criminals have become the culture. You know, the drug trade is just so prevalent. And again, with the media and government in cahoots, you don't really know what the real numbers are. But, when I drive through Detroit or Los Angeles, I'm just not seeing a lot of real economic activity. I'm seeing a lot of what I would regard as drug trade and welfare, activity.
It's parasitical. It's harvesting. I heard an account where in Pennsylvania, the former factory for Bethlehem Steel was converted into a casino by Sheldon Adelson.
So, thanks a lot, Sheldon.
That's the new growth model. Casinos, right? A good example idea of community. You tell that story when that friend of yours, where some guy came in peddling pornography, and they just beat him up.
Yeah, they didn't. They didn't worry about laws. It was just they weren't going to go to the police. They were just going to get rid of this guy.
Yeah,
The dads knew that this was morally wrong, morally debasing, and they felt empowered to be able to defend their children.
Mm-hmm. Right? Just and like so, yeah, there was a case I heard a guy talking. He was talking to his grandfather about when he was young. There was a girl who went on a date with a local, and he sexually assaulted her. And she told the sheriff, and the sheriff went to the girl's father and asked the father, "How do you want to handle this?" And the father said, "We'll take care of it." And the guy disappeared.
Yeah, and that was a truly healthy culture. That's a healthy culture right there. You know, the the use of laws to control us by the secret society is very, very clever. It would be a topic, good topic for us to discuss at some point.
And another thing is that you hear that story, you say, what about due process? I understand the hazards in lynching and going in, sure. in street justice and all that stuff. But only problem is, what are the abuses that are so prevalent in current court system?
And that's the thing is that you have to compare one with the other. The idea that if you submit to the state, you're going to end up with a perfect worker's paradise. I'm sorry, you might have been able to pull off that one in like 1905, but after the Bolshevik Revolution and the Holodomor, I think, you know, maybe European culture should maybe get a little bit like a head scratching when someone comes up with a worker's paradise. And that's what they're offering them, right? That's really it's just a cover story that they say, and you know, it's interesting, like feminism, fascinating how few women identify with the term now, because what has happened is women, I think, understand that they want to be in a family structure, right? That they know that their best life is there. Mm-hmm. It's not as CEO of like some corporation. Their really best life is with children, with a husband, with an extended family. I mean, that's really where you have the best existence, and yet they can't produce families.
Yeah, that's right? Where you feel most fulfilled, because you're in constant need. You don't even think it's the day-to-day thing. It's the, you know, it's the putting the Band-Aid on the scraped knee. It's the getting husband's clothes ready. It's getting meals out. It's all these things. So your life, you're constantly in need. You're fulfilled. Yeah. And I guess that would be described as what? Who was it? The feminine mystique. This is the comfortable concentration camp. But if you look at her life, what was her name?
Betty Friedan.
Betty Friedan. She herself wasn't a very stable human being, and she's writing this book.
She was a nut job, Anyway, I won't not get into her, but
I know it's all another.
I mean, the thing is that we had a process of culture production that, it was in existence when Homo sapien was created, mm-hmm. right? It's hundreds of thousands of years, millions probably in terms of ancestral, behavioral input. This is how we're supposed to find our best life is in the structure of a family. And the idea that, well, we're going to get rid of this, and you know what, this welfare state, this pornographic world, that this is all going to somehow be better. Oh man, people just have to wake up, you know, and you really have to defend. It's, you know, that individual, he made the comment, you know, that there's not people available now to defend culture, right? Mm-hmm. In the piece that you read. And that's really the truth. And that's why when I say, you know, developing strength and virtue, that this is where it ends up. You end up being able to defend it. And I mean, and sometimes you're just going to have to defend it with your fists, because believe me, the secret society, just think of, the population as cattle. And anyone who stands up against their sophistry or their mind control, they're leading the whole population into oblivion, is going to basically, be subjected to violence or legal violence. And so you just, if you want to, defend your future, you have to accept the risk and to say, so what? There's really no purpose in existence if we're just going to all be, the whole ethnicity is in oblivion in 50 years. You know, we need to defend ourselves.
Mm-hmm. We have to, we shall overcome, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the battle hymn of the Republic.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, that's another, like, I think Masonic kind of,
yes,
kind of, you know, wordplay. But anyway, hey, Tim, great conversation, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Great.
Thank you very, very much. I just, there's so much. It's almost like every point we go over leads to, you know, things we really need to cover even in more depth. But I think this is a pretty good first pulse at it.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, I'll let you go.
Okay, buddy. Well, thank you so much.
Enjoy the weekend. We'll talk next
Friday. We'll do it again next week. All right. Bye-bye.
So long. Bye-bye.
Bye.